Welcome to the Dildork's Dorky Discourse on Sex, Dating, and Masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I think the most common way I non-verbally flirt is by blushing and giggling. So probably need to work on that. Who are you, friend?
Oh God, I blush so much.
Oh, it's unavoidable. How do you stop yourself once it starts? I don't.
My face is just pink all the time.
Do people call you out on it?
Oh, every time, all the time.
That's the worst, because then it just gets worse.
Yeah. I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator and sex blogger or some shit. I don't know, but I blush all the time, and my face shows every feeling that I have ever had, and It is simultaneously the worst and the best.
Yep, it's a lot. We're talking about nonverbal communication today.
So I think this was a listener suggestion, because our listeners always have some really clever ideas on what we should do episodes on, and I love when we get their suggestions. If not, I was just feeling real clever, and I'm going to hype myself up, I guess. But we're talking about nonverbal communication today, and I'm curious, just overall, how confident are you in, like, reading other people's nonverbal communication and, like, communicating nonverbally yourself?
I actually feel like I'm so bad at this, and I think it's because my whole brain feels like it's organized around words, and so When I reflect on a memory, I'm usually thinking about what words were said, and sometimes I lose my sense of, like, how they were said and, like, what was going on while they were said because I just focus so much on the words. And so I think I'm not always good at, like, detecting when somebody is non-verbally flirting with me unless they, like, actually say that they're flirting with me. So that's been not always a great thing. And I also feel like I'm not good at communicating non-verbally. Like, I always want to state things really clearly in words because I don't like miscommunication and ambiguity. So this might be kind of a weird episode for me.
It's funny. I lean a lot on language and wanting to explain things explicitly because I feel like I'm really bad at subtext, but not necessarily bad at nonverbal communication. And I don't know if those are, like, two sides of the same coin. But it's, like, when things are implied, or I get weirdly anxious around any kind of slang or jargon, even if I know what it means, I still look shit up because I'm constantly, like, I get really anxious around miscommunication with language. But I think I'm also prone to overemphasizing nonverbal communication and seeing things and assuming they're done on purpose. Because I know I put a lot of thought into the nonverbal communication or the choice in the way I phrase things because I get really nervous about miscommunicating. And I think I attribute that onto other people as well. And assume that they're doing it, whereas a lot of people are just kind of fucking talking.
Yeah.
Like, there's no code for me to try and figure out. They're just talking.
No, you can't. There's no, like, objective way to translate these things. I remember when I was a kid, I would read all these teen magazines, and they would talk a lot about flirting techniques. And one that's recommended really often is, like, casual touch. Like, you know, touching someone's arm or their shoulder when you're making a point or when they make you laugh or something. And I think I internalized that so deeply that now if someone does casually touch me while we're talking, I kind of am, like, immediately like, is this person flirting with me? Like, even if it's, like, kind of not an appropriate scenario for that, or, like, they wouldn't expect them to be flirting with me, like, I kind of assume that. And that's maybe not great. Like, it probably says something about our culture's relationship with touch.
Yeah. I think something that's interesting, though, because a lot of those magazines growing up had articles like that, but we almost culturally, there's this, like, myth of the person who can learn so much about you just by your body language. You know, you're Sherlock or Gregory House type character, you know.
And then there's
that
those, like,
just looks at you and reads everything.
There's those gossip magazines where they'll show pictures of celebrity couples and try to analyze how their relationship is going based on their body language toward each other. And it's like, you captured them for one moment. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean anything at all. It's really weird.
Yeah, and, like, It's hard because there is also a lot of science in the way we communicate non-verbally, in the tones we use, in the body language we use, and the, you know, how close we are to the people we're talking to. Like, all of this does communicate things, and it all communicates wildly different things depending on your culture and your context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what are some ways that you are conscious of using body language when you're talking to someone you're interested in?
Proximity is probably one of the bigger things. If I'm into someone, I generally stand closer to someone. A little bit inside of what culturally for us would be considered personal space. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, just like just a step inside their bubble, just because it creates a little bit of intimacy. And again, this is like if I have somewhat of a rapport with someone, and it makes it easier for those like moments of casual touch. And more open body language. So I might be leaning towards them or leaning into them. I'm not going to like cross my arms, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a fan of what I call the table lean, which is when you're sitting across from someone at a table on a date, perhaps, and you lean a little farther closer to them than you need to necessarily. It's one of those things that's like almost so subtle that you could almost not notice it. And all you would really perceive is that you're feeling the kinds of things you feel when someone gets close to you, which might be like heart speeding up, blushing a little bit, that kind of thing. And it's almost imperceptible and it gives you plausible deniability because like, it's not so extreme that it looks weird, but
see the thing with the table lean, the thing with the table lean for me is that I always do it subconsciously in reaction to something, so it becomes much more obvious. Mm-hmm. Usually it's like during some sort of kink conversation or them telling me about something I don't know, like something that that's always my reaction to being fascinated. But it happens a lot on dates and things, like people will say a kink thing and it's always leaning all the way forward and so tell me more about that. And I get called out on it all the time because it's like so obvious the way my attention gets caught.
One that I do that's very sort of high school or maybe even middle school is if I'm like sitting next to someone like on a couch or on the subway or something and I'm into them, sometimes I might sort of like lean on them in a way where it's like, oh, I'm just tired, you know, so I just need to lean on you. But it's like actually very flirty and just an excuse to get close to them. And it can sometimes be how I sort of break the touch barrier with a person I haven't really touched before.
Mm-hmm.
I remember our mutual friend, whose name I will not say, who I went on some like weird pseudo dates with. I couldn't figure out if he wanted to be my friend or he wanted to date me. Like, he was very shy. He was not communicating it. And I remember we were hanging out in this bar and he just looked at me. He was like, cuddles? And I was like,
yes.
Okay. Is that like a thing that people do platonically? I really didn't know. I wrote in my journal that night, like, do people cuddle their friends platonically in bars on couches? Like, is that a normal thing that people do?
No, but we're queer,
so yes. As it turned out, he was into me. That's true, yeah. Do you think that queers have a higher propensity for, like, casual physical intimacy?
Oh, absolutely. I think mm-hmm. we're just... our culture is just more comfortable with intimacy in general. Be it emotional and physical, I think. But I do think... I definitely think... physical touch is a part of our culture. Queers tend to be very affectionate, at least the ones I spend a lot of time with.
Yeah, and I would also say that what I've noticed in like queer dating versus straight dating is like queers have a bit more of a permeable barrier between platonic and not platonic. Mm-hmm. So like there's a little bit more fluidity in between those two spaces, whereas I feel like every time I've dated in like a straight context, it's been very rigidly like we are either only friends or we're dating. There's no in between there.
Yeah. And I definitely do you cuddle your friends kind of thing in a room full of straight people is like I've been in rooms where that's, like, you know, the conversation, or, like, that falls up there with, like, you know, would you let them hang out with a bunch of girlfriends when you're not around, and, like, that kind of stuff that I just mm-hmm. don't see in queer culture.
Yeah, and you have this sort of, like, monogamy culture toxic thought where it's, like, some people think cuddling is cheating, which, like,
yeah.
I am very much of the opinion that if you and your partner agree on a definition of cheating, you should both stick to it and respect it. So if that is what you've agreed on, fine, whatever. If that's what needs to be sacred for you to feel good and safe in your relationship, fine. But to me, that's just really strange. Like, our culture just really freaks out about casual physical intimacy.
Yeah. I'm curious. I think there's a lot of discussion about nonverbal communication on dates and, like, as flirting and as code. And I think there is, we're more prone to kind of hyper-analyzing that as well, right? When you're out with someone, you're like, what things did they do? Were there any signs that I missed, you know? Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about nonverbal communication, like, during sex, and what kind of things you look out for to just kind of gauge your activity with your partner. Because I know in sex positive culture, we talk a lot about using your words, which is super helpful and does not always happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated topic because definitely I regard clear verbal consent as the gold standard, but that certainly does not mean everybody hits that standard. And I also don't think it's reasonable to want every, like, okay, you can set your own boundaries. If you need clear verbal consent every time, that's cool. But I think most people don't feel that way. I think most people, especially with, like, an established partner or something, have the sense of nonverbal consent as a thing that exists. And for me, that looks like moaning, leaning into whatever we're doing, grabbing the person, pulling them closer, just, like, being engaged in what we're doing. Like, the times when someone has continued doing things to me when I have completely frozen up or am, in some cases, like, actively backing away are always the times when I'm like, how are you this bad at reading people? Like, how are you paying this little attention to me?
Yeah.
And it's often, like, when I'm, like, dissociating during sex or when, like, they're doing something that doesn't feel good for me. And I feel like I'm very attuned to that in my partner, so it's always really weird for me when somebody isn't attuned to that in me. I don't really know where that comes from. Maybe we don't have enough opportunities to practice that skill.
Yeah, I don't think we do. And I think also, culturally, unfortunately, there is a lot of narrative as sex being a thing that happens to the female partner or the receptive partner, which doesn't necessarily create a narrative that expects active and engaged participation.
Yeah, it's sort of like a yes until it's no type of situation, which is not how you want your consent to go. Like, that's how it is at swinger clubs, and we, you know, rag on them because assume yes until no approach is, in my view, really not healthy and not the right way to go about it. But it does seem to be, like, that definitely does seem to be how it has been when I have hooked up with particularly straight dudes. Like, queer dudes are more cool about it, usually. They're more kind of, like, attuned to me. I don't want to, like, make a blanket statement, but that has been my experience.
I think it's because they're open to more active, or culture includes more active communications around sex, right? You think, you know, even just a cis gay guy is gonna say top or bottom when they're fucking someone, or things are gonna get awkward. Like, there is at least a bare minimum of communication that has to happen to anyone whose body doesn't fit or sexuality doesn't fit the exact narrative. And I think it just opens people up to looking for more things. I think one of the things you were talking about earlier about consent not necessarily being, once you have, like, an established relationship, not necessarily being a verbal conversation every time. It also might not be a verbal conversation for everything that you do. Because sex is a series of getting little consent, like, little pieces of consent, right? And everyone always jumps to, like, ugh, consent culture. I'm going to have to ask before I touch someone everywhere. Like, no, you ask for major things and, like, slower escalations. You ask non-verbally. And I think nonverbal communication happens the same way or similarly to the way verbal communication can, right? And if you're the only one taking action or the only one communicating and you're not noticing what your person is communicating back, you're dominating the conversation and being an asshole. I know because I talk a lot and I'm the person perpetually making sure I'm not that person.
I think that the way that nonverbal consent operates a lot of the time is we group together certain activities as like naturally flowing into each other. So like if you're kissing someone, we generally might assume that you have the person's consent to perhaps touch their face or their hair while you're doing that. Mm-hmm. If you start like touching their upper chest, maybe you have their consent to move a little lower onto their tits or whatever. And the problem, I think, is when people start to make unreasonable jumps between those different groups. So, like, I'm thinking of things like kissing someone and then you suddenly slap their face, or like someone's blowing you and you shove their dick down or their throat down on your dick or something, where it's like it's not reasonable to assume that someone would be into that based on that. But I mean, this is obviously an inexact science, and obviously, like, if you're confused about any of this, the best recourse is just to fucking ask.
Yeah, absolutely. But generally, if there's something like, you know, I'm making out with someone and I want to touch a part of their body I haven't yet, you know, maybe I want to touch their chest or grab their ass, I might put my hand like lower on their hip and see, does their body move into my hand or does it recoil, right? And things like that, where, you know, it's an, like you said, it's an imperfect science, and sometimes you might slip on a landmine. And this is harm reduction, and this is tends to be what sex looks like in, when you're having it. Like, stopping to have verbal conversation about everything isn't practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even, like, not just about consent, but also about, like, pleasure during sex. I often use nonverbal communication to be, like, to communicate, yes, that feels good, I want more of that, continue doing that. And it always, like, throws me off when people don't read that very well. Like, I'll be, like, moaning and tensing, and someone will, like, stop and do a different thing. And I'm always kind of like, that seems strange to me. But again, like, our sex ed sucks. Like, this is, like, really basic stuff that people should be taught, and that to some of us seems fairly intuitive, but that doesn't mean it's intuitive to everybody. And, like, it really, really sucks that it's not taught. Like, these are basic social skills in a way.
Right. And, I mean, that said, I do want to take a moment to recognize that we're both socialized as women, and we're people who are, as women, we're taught to subconsciously pay attention to everyone's pleasure around us and comfort and accommodate for that. And I know I personally, like, my past and my nature as a person makes me even more attuned to that. I've been reading up on attachment theory lately. Maybe we'll do a podcast on that at some point. But one of the things it talks about is people who have a more anxious attachment style are also very prone to hyper-analyzing people for these cues and being really attentive looking for it. Yeah.
That makes so much sense.
And I read it and I was like, oh, yeah, that checks out. Yeah. Because people who, and there would be a whole podcast on that, but people with anxious avoidance styles are very much like constantly afraid they're going to lose you once you're here.
Yeah.
So, of course, they would be constantly monitoring situations for any sign that they've done something wrong and want to fix it.
Right. Drag me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I read the book and I was like, well, thanks. Appreciate that. Cool.
You know what that reminds me of is, like, there have been so many times during sex when I have perceived some shift in energy or some change in expression, some small thing, and I stopped what I was doing and I was like, are you okay? Do you want this? Do you want me to stop? And the person was like, what are you talking about? I'm into it. Yeah. And I was just misreading the situation, probably based on what you were just talking about. And so, I mean, I think it's better to err on the side of being careful, for sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it just goes to show how badly you can misread those nonverbal cues sometimes.
Yeah, which is exactly why we're talking about not relying on them for, like, huge jumps, right? Mm-hmm. You're making out with someone, someone moans and, you know, pushes their hip forward. That does not mean put your dick in them. Like, that maybe means put your hand on their waistband and, like, raise an eyebrow and see if they, like, nod and let you unbutton their pants, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there are again, little baby steps and allow them to come back to you. The same way if you're having a conversation with someone new, you might say 3 or 4 sentences and then let them go. And mm-hmm. if they sit there in silence and stare at you after those 3 seconds, you probably don't keep talking to them. Like, they probably don't want to be there.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, too, that those assumptions of reasonability are very culturally based. Mm-hmm. They really shift depending on what culture you're in. Like, I'm thinking of ever since choking kind of went mainstream, it's been a thing where, like, I've had partners assume that because I am kinky and submissive that I would be into being choked because it's become that standard of a thing. I actually just read an article recently, I think, on Mel Magazine about people who get non-consensually choked and like how it's become this weird epidemic in millennial culture. Mm-hmm. But just a few years ago, that wasn't the case. That wasn't something that you could expect that someone would just randomly do without consenting sex. I mean, these days we shouldn't expect it either, but it does happen. And so, yeah, it's weird how those norms shift over time and in different cultures.
Yeah, it's... I think it's a matter of what is in the cultural zeitgeist as, like, the acceptable menu for sex, the things right. that people think might happen, and somehow mm-hmm. that got added to today's specials, I guess, the past couple of years.
Yeah, just I like, was just watching last night one of Margaret Cho's comedy specials, and she's bi, but she, like, sort of identifies as a lesbian, or she talks about that in the special. And she was talking about how she doesn't like when people go down on her, but in lesbian culture, that's, like, just kind of an expected thing mm-hmm. to do. And, yeah, it's really hard when you don't like things that are very much considered, like, standard and go-to. Like, I'm also thinking about, like, people with vaginas who have vaginismus, who mm-hmm. like, especially like if they're dating cis men, it's like the assumption is that PIV sex will be on the table because that's just like the most standard sex act, I guess. And like for them, it's like not something they necessarily want to do or can do. And it's hard to like talk about that.
Yeah. How do you navigate if something, you ever get the vibe when you're playing with someone that they think something's on the table and you want to like gracefully remove it from the table?
Yeah, I mean, I try to detect that as early as possible and state it verbally as mm-hmm. early as possible. So like I've had situations with my friend with benefits sometimes where I just wasn't in the mood for sex and I knew that up front. So early in our makeouts, I would be like, I'm not really in the mood for sex tonight, but I would love to make out with you. And then we might discuss, you know, or perhaps come to some kind of compromise on that. Because I don't want the person to get to a point where they're like super excited to do a thing that they think they're going to get to do. Like, I don't like disappointing people in that way. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the onus is on them to like accept it and be fine with it because that's how boundaries and consent work. But I prefer to circumvent that one early.
Yeah. I do, too. And I'll notice sometimes if someone's, like, because for me, sometimes that changes daily, and sometimes I don't know that I'm not down for something until it's already happening, mm-hmm. especially because gender stuff, and suddenly I'm like, oh, wow, that doesn't feel good right now. Good to know. Note to self. Yeah. And so sometimes I'll, like, have that conversation beforehand, like, as a part of my negotiation, I might say things like, I may or may not take off my shirt so that I don't mm-hmm. feel like they're constantly waiting for me to.
Yeah.
Just know that that makes just might not happen.
It makes me wonder about, like, in a long-term, like, established relationship, whether you would develop, like, nonverbal shorthands for different dysphoria moods and states, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like, I love the idea of, like, just wearing something different to bed or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know that stuff can be hard to talk about. So, like, maybe not needing to talk about it sometimes would be better.
Yeah, totally. And just, I mean, in a longer term thing, people kind of get a feel for, like, the touchier areas and approach them with more caution than they might with another person. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have a long-term partner and like, you know, if they, you know, they have feelings about their chest, you may not like go for taking their shirt off right away, which is one of the first things that happens in a lot of like makeouts, getting hot and heavy, right? You stick your hands up the back of their shirt or you start to lift their shirt up or whatever. So a person mm-hmm. might, that might be a moment someone would pause if they're more used to knowing that that's a more sensitive area for you.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I'll just non-verbally do what you kind of talked about doing verbally with, like, smaller stuff, where I'll just, like, redirect their hand and be like, actually, I'd rather do, and, like, move it somewhere else. Or verbally offer another thing. Because what I like is that, and we talk about this all the time, but the way you focused on, like, but I would love to do this. Like, this is what I'm excited about. Because, unfortunately, we don't talk about no's during sex a whole lot, culturally. Mm-hmm. So I think people hear one no and panic and think no means stop all of the things all of the time. And it's not necessarily a red. Like,
I wrote a piece recently where I said that culturally we understand saying no or, like, stopping sex in the middle of sex as, like, akin to throwing a drink in someone's face as far as, like, social faux pas. Like, it feels very affronting. We really need to deal with that better. Because, like, even I, as, like, a person who's, like, reasonably entrenched in sex positive culture, if someone does try to stop me from doing something in the middle of sex, I do get a little bit spirally about, like, shit, what did I do wrong, and, like, how do I fix it, and, like, does this mean this person hates me? And I just get very, like, in my head about it, and it's because we're not taught how to deal with that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. This reminds me, actually, I was looking at a thread by my friend Ida Mondelez. They're reviewing, or, well, talking about a book they're reading called Screw Consent by Joseph Fischel, which is super interesting, and if you want to go read their thread, you should do that. And it's talking about how consent as a single barometer for good and acceptable sex is lacking, and it needs more. We need to have more conversations about different things, and if we lump everything into the one consent conversation, we're kind of diluting that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, super fascinating. But one of the things they said in the thread is, unsurprisingly, sex being a taboo topic for many things means that anything involves it automatically gets wackier and more intense than its non-sexual counterparts and equivalences. And this is the part that really stood out to me, is they said, sex is both special and not hyper-visible and invisible. And I think that really speaks to how we kind of create this weird bubble around sex where we think any sort of interruption of it is, like, breaking this special taboo little bubble where these things happen and those things can't happen outside. And separating it from the way we act in the rest of the world because it has so much taboo looped up in it.
Yeah. That reminds me of, do you know Connor Habib, the porn star?
Yeah,
he's brilliant. He had a thread, like, years ago about how sex isn't inherently good or immersive. Mm-hmm. He got so much flack for it because people are like, if you're not fully immersed in the sex you're having, you can't be having good sex. And he was just saying, like, it isn't inherently those things. Like, there is such a thing as bad sex or sex that you're checked out of or sex that you're, like, not paying super close attention to, or this just isn't working. And we really stigmatize sex that isn't perfect and that doesn't flow perfectly from beginning to end because, exactly what you're describing. And it's like, it really makes people feel shitty when sex doesn't happen for them the way that they expect it to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to think, if you remove a lot of the taboo, yes, there is a lot of intimacies, right? It's something that happens to and inside of many of our bodies. And that does make it different from a lot of other things. But it's also a social activity and a hobby and a thing that we do with people we care about. And I might have a really great day baking, and I might have a really bad day baking where, like, my cakes don't rise and, you know, my caramel crystallizes and everything's garbage. But, like, there are varying degrees with any activity you do.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't think of sex that way.
If your dough doesn't rise, should you take Piagra?
No. Excuse pies me. Don't even rise.
I'm not a baker.
You literally want to avoid the crust rising. That's why we blind bake.
All right. That was the yeast good pun I've ever made.
All right, fine. I guess you saved it. We got a little off topic.
We veered very off topic, we did. But I'm into it.
Yeah, no, it's I'm super fascinating. It. But I think I do want to bring it back a little bit. One of the things we talked about as a sign, a pretty basic sign of, no, I'm not down for this, is someone backing away, right? Or, like, recoiling from your touch, which sounds really dramatic, but doesn't necessarily have to be, right?
Yeah.
It can be anything from, like, a little flinch to just kind of leaning away and, like, avoiding just a little bit. And that's generally a sign to, hey, back off. Except I do that when people hit me. And I usually want them to hit me again.
Yeah, if I think of scenes that have sensations that are difficult for me, whether it be pain or tickling or even sometimes like fisting stuff, like anything that's like difficult to take, my body will sometimes physically recoil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a situation where, like, if we haven't discussed it, a partner might be like, whoa, are you okay? Do you want me to stop? And so it's good to discuss it and to get a sense for each other. Because, like, my partner knows if I, like, wriggle away from them during a spanking, I probably still want to be hit. I'm just, like, my body is reacting to what's happening, and that's fine.
Yeah. I really enjoy, in a spanking in particular, but this is one of the reasons why, part of my negotiation, I try to remember to ask, how do I know when things are feeling well, and how do I know when things are feeling good, feeling well? That's not right. How do I know when you feel great, and how do I know when you want a thing to stop?
Yeah.
And what does that look like in your body? But for me, one of the things I really enjoy is impact that maybe gets overwhelming and maybe leaves me, like, squirming just a little bit out of the way. Because I find, for me, impact is very much an endurance thing. So being able to stay there and take it for a while is important to me and is part of it. But if someone's hitting me a bunch of times in quick succession in, like, either the same place or similar areas, and it becomes very overwhelming and very, like, chaotic and frantic, then I will often, like, squeal and jump and start to pull away and start to try to avoid it, because it gets very, very close to that edge. And then I like them to back off, and I like to have a second for me to breathe and then reset and have... It's really satisfying for me to set myself back up to be hit again and have that moment.
Yeah, because that's a nonverbal signal in itself.
Exactly.
To your person hitting you, like, you're ready to be hit more.
Exactly, which, like, generally for spanking for me is, like, arching my back and leaning a little back towards them again and, like, creating a good target area. Versus, you know, when you're getting hit a lot of times, you're, you know, you'll curl inward, and especially if it's your ass, you're, like, pulling it forward and, like, stop. So being able to reset for that feels really powerful for me, too, and I think it really emphasizes my autonomy in the situation and makes it very much I am deciding for this to continue happening to me, and this person is paying attention to those cues and is going to continue hurting me because they can see that I'm ready for it and they can see that I can take it.
Yeah, that reminds me of how I deal with face slapping, which is, like, that's a thing where I really, really don't like to be surprised with it.
Mm-hmm.
In part because, like, I need to set my jaw a certain way so my teeth don't fucking go sideways in my skull when somebody hits me.
Right.
And so I negotiated with my partner that if they want to hit me on the face, they have to, like, put their hand on my face and, like, wait until we make eye contact. And that kind of establishes, like, okay, I know what you're about to do and I'm ready for it. And there'll be times in between hits where I get so overwhelmed by sensation that my eyes are closed and might be backing away. And then we just wait until I'm, you know, recentered and ready to be hit again. And we do that eye contact again. And that's, like, great nonverbal communication. That works fantastic for me.
Mm-hmm. And it's a moment of grounding.
Yeah, totally. And it's a moment of, it's almost like saying a green safe word in a way. Because if I didn't want it to continue at any point in that process, I could say, please stop, or yellow, or whatever. But I come back to center and give the go ahead. And that's nice.
Mm-hmm. And we did just briefly blow past it. But how do you have to hold your teeth when you're getting slapped in the face if you don't want to fuck them up?
I don't really know how to describe it, like, centered.
Don't clench your jaw, but don't hold it open. So let your teeth, your teeth are, like, your mouth is closed, but you're not, like, clenching your jaw or grinding your teeth. It's relaxed, but it's still closed and, like, in place.
Yeah. I don't want to be caught by surprise at a moment when I might be, like, biting my lip or like my tongue's in a weird spot or something, because then there might be mouth carnage of some kind. So
yeah.
I just prefer to not be surprised with that.
And,
also it's like a very disorienting thing in general. So like even mentally, emotionally, I don't really want to be surprised with that.
Yeah. And if you're slack jawed and they catch the bottom of your jaw, it's not going to be a good time.
Yeah. And also, like, if you move your head at all when someone's about to slap your face, they could get your ear, they could get your jawbone, like any number of things. So you want to be, like, at least somewhat still when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I like about kink, though, is it creates a lot of opportunities for creating those nonverbal cues and very explicitly negotiating and discussing them and building them into your scenes. Because we
do. Yes, it's wonderful.
I mean, a lot of kink involves some kind of role play, whether it's structured or whether it's just DS in general. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's just you're in charge and that's the role we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times we build in these nonverbal cues to just not break the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so, like, I often like to role play as a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually submissive when I role play. And, like you said, it would probably break the illusion for me to say something like, "Daddy, spank me right now." That wouldn't really feel good for me in my submissive identity. Like, it wouldn't feel congruous. It wouldn't feel hot.
Mm-hmm.
So what I might do instead is like flip over onto my stomach and wiggle my ass around a lot and see what that does. And that usually does the trick. But like you develop, especially in like a longer term thing, you develop these like shorthands and like codes with each other that you know mean certain things. So you don't have to ask necessarily outright for what you want,
mm-hmm.
Which might sound weird and counterintuitive because it's good to ask for what you want, but if what I want is the illusion that I am not in control, then there are lots of nonverbal fun ways to achieve that.
Yeah, and you are still asking for what you want.
Just yes, and non-verbal. I am still in control, which is important. Yeah,
exactly. It may not be necessarily, I don't want to say the most effective, but necessarily the most precise form mm-hmm. of asking for what you want. But the way you talked about it, it is effective in other ways and effective at, you know, other means.
Yes. So funny story related to this. I don't know if you remember this. I went on a drinks date with a boy from Tinder who was like ostensibly very vanilla, but he had like kind of mentioned spanking a little bit. So I was a little bit like, I wonder. And I mentioned on the date that I enjoyed sometimes being spanked with books. And we went back to my place, and he was a literature guy. So I went and got my hardcover copy of Lolita and showed it to him. I was like, "Look at this cool book I have." And then I laid on my stomach with my ass in the air. Just an invitation.
Just casually.
Let's see how it goes. And he did not take the bait. He did not even inquire about it. I mean, that was a first time encounter, so it was on me to ask for that if I wanted that, but I did think that was pretty funny, because I do think a dommier, kinkier person would have been like, "Oh, I see what you're doing.
Oh, look, a butt." Well, I think that's the thing, because nonverbal communication has jargon, almost, within communities in ways that it probably doesn't elsewhere. And there are things like within the kink community, averting eye contact, depending on if you're in like especially more traditional old guard areas, you might be signaling your submission. But if you do that outside of a kink scene dynamic or culture or whatever, people are gonna be like, "The fuck, just fucking look at me." Like that wouldn't necessarily occur to them at all. So it's very much the community you're in and the rules of that community can deeply influence what your nonverbal communication even means and can make it even harder to communicate with the people you're with.
Hey folks, we forgot to say this in the show, so I'm just going to edit it in here. Bex is raising money for his top surgery, which is coming up in October, and he's put up a page on GoFundMe to help raise some money to cover the out-of-pocket costs of that. So if you want to contribute to that, you can go to girly.click/helpbex, all lowercase, girly.click/helpbex, girly.click/helpbex, and that is where you can contribute some dollars to help cover Bex's top surgery and all the associated charges. That would be really lovely of you. Obviously not required, but every little bit helps. Thanks. I'll let you get back to the show. Okay, we got a listener question, which is, how do you know when someone is flirting with you or if they're just kind of a naturally touchy-feely person? Which is tricky. I have met these people. They confuse me very much because I am not touchy-feely in that way. But yeah, it is hard to read when they're flirting with you, especially if you don't know the person. So you don't know, like, if they're touching everybody. I would say, like, maybe a good way to gauge it if you're in a group situation is see how they relate with other people, see if they're touching everybody that way or a lot of people. That might give you a sense of it. You can pay attention to how consistent it is over multiple meetings with the person. Another fun thing is you can maybe like call them out on it a little bit and see how they react to that. Like, oh, you're touching me a lot, or like, that's some flirty touching or whatever, and see how they respond to that.
Do you hug everyone this much, or you just think I'm cute?
Right. That's perfect. I love it. You're a flirting genius.
Yeah, I think that's really good. I think the other thing that's somewhat related to this is the way we talked about how some people are on constant high alert for these like nonverbal signals so that they can basically almost cut off any rejection at the past, right? If I notice it before you're going to hurt me, I can do something about it.
Yeah, that's very real.
That's fully what that's, you know, and it's an evolutionary thing. It's something our brains learn to do to protect us, and it fully makes sense.
It's in some cases almost like a trauma response. Like
exactly.
Adaptation.
You know, like, well, I was working through this. I was like looking at my childhood and I was like, oh, yeah, that checks out. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
That's why I am the way I am. But
I'm the person in my relationships who's constantly like, you said this one weird thing. Does that mean you're going to break up with me? And often my partners are like, what are you talking about?
When did I say that? And you're like, here's the screenshot. I've analyzed it with 17 of my friends already. Yeah. I'm allowed to roast you because I too am this person.
Okay, good.
And I think one of the key things is, whenever you're studying any sort of nonverbal communication, what they teach you to look for is clusters of information. So you never make a judgment based on, you know, oh, their arms were crossed. They must hate me. They must not want to be around me. Okay. Or it was cold.
Right.
Or, you know, they were slightly uncomfortable, or their stomach was bothering them, or someone on the other side of the room was looking at them weird and they were just like, ugh. But they're having a grand old time with you. Like, there are so many other reasons for one thing to be happening. But if their arms are crossed and they're leaning away from you and they're constantly looking around the room and it kind of looks like they're looking for an escape, they might not like you. Like, that's fair. So looking for clusters of three or more things that might lead you to believe this person's into you. So if they're very touchy-feely, are they also maybe saying things that are flirty? Or is this, are they being very touchy-feeling over, like you said, clusters of meetings? Like, are you seeing it every time you're around them? They're touching you in a certain way and not other people. Because this is such a gray area, you can't necessarily, one piece of data is not enough to draw a conclusion. You want to look at wider sample sizes and draw conclusions based on collections of information.
Yep, very good points. You can also look at their signals in other areas. Mm-hmm. Are they trying to spend a lot of time with you? Are they saying flirty things? Are they saying complimentary things?
Are they remembering specific things about you and things that you like?
Yeah, are they seeking you out? you know?
Mm-hmm.
I always think that you should judge whether someone likes you based on what they do and not necessarily what they say. Because if I really like someone, I might seem really cool and, like, unconcerned in terms of what I'm saying around them. But I will, like, make time to, like, find them and talk to them and reach out to them. And that really says more about whether I like them than what I'm saying or whether I'm touching them or not, you know?
People are so much more conscious of what they say than they are of pretty much everything right. else that they communicate.
Exactly, because that feeling of, like, slight desperation of when you like someone so much that you want to see them a lot, it's really hard to mask that or to suppress that. And so it's quite easy to read it on people, usually.
And the fun thing about that is if it's a relationship that's going somewhere, if this person is into you too, they are also trying to mask that energy and find excuses to talk to you. So you kind of get into this game where you're like, yes, no, this is a totally reasonable thing for us to be talking about, and we're not grasping at straws at all to continue having this conversation. This is fine. Because you can recognize those conversations where you're like, none of this is of substance. We're literally just, like, someone sends you a message and you're like, wow, that was a complete non sequitur. But I also want to keep talking to them. So let's talk about this new thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how, like, initiating conversations could in some ways be considered nonverbal communication, because it's like the initiation is itself not the verbal part of it. I wasn't really making a solid
no that there. Totally makes sense. When you talk about nonverbal communication, so we're getting my communications nerd in here, when we talk about, because I've taken multiple classes on just this in college.
I love what a nerd you are.
I know, they were so fun. But when people think of nonverbal communication, they think of body language. They think of them being synonymous, and they're not. Nonverbal mm-hmm. communication also includes the tone of voice you're using, the speed at which you're talking, your proximity to that other person.
The voice stuff is so big for me because I definitely have a different voice when I'm talking to someone I have a crush on. And I also will, like, giggle a lot, and I might talk faster than I normally would because I'm nervous. And I think that you can tell, like, I won't reveal any details, but there's one episode of this podcast where we had on someone who I had a big crush on at the time. And when I was editing it, I was like, I don't normally sound like this. This is not what my voice sounds like. And it was so stark to me. Like, I had never really thought about that before, but it was immediately noticeable to me. It was so weird.
Yeah. And people who know who know you can see it, and people who know me can see it, I'm sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because I know who I am as a human. I have no chill. Like, I'm a terrible poker player. This is why I don't do, like, in-person sex work and stuff, because I have no poker face, and if a client annoyed me, I'd be like, well, fuck you, and you can't do that. every feeling I have is just all over my face. That said, though, I find that to be pretty helpful as a submissive person, because dominants mm-hmm. tend to like that.
Yeah, so that's the second listener question we got for the week is, do you have any suggestions for signals to use when a sub or bottom goes nonverbal? Which is something that we both have a ton of experience with. Yep. Thank you for asking this question. Yeah, there are a lot of things that are in my toolkit. I think that for me, like, it's not that I can't say words at that point. It's just that, like, it often doesn't occur to me to say words, even if I kind of need to.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's helpful for me to have a top ask very specific questions, very simple, quick to answer questions, which is why, like, what color are you is really good. And then I can say red, yellow, or green, which is so simple. The thing is, like, it's so fucking simple, and yet sometimes I actually don't even know. Like, sometimes I'm so, so spacey, I'm like, couldn't tell you. But that's a really good one. What another good one is, like, do you want me to keep going? I like that better than do you want me to stop, because I think a sub typically, even if they kind of do want you to stop, they won't want to tell you that.
Yeah.
So I think getting the affirmative on you want me to keep going is maybe better, mm-hmm. but I don't know. It depends on the person.
Or things like, if it's an impact thing, how many more?
Yeah, my partner does that all the time. When I'm like reaching my limit, they'll be like, "You can, you're gonna take X many more, like between 5 and 10, or between 10 and 20, or whatever it is." And then I get to choose, and they can also like gauge based on the number I say how hard I can take it. Because if they say 10 to 20 and I'm like 20, fuck yes, then maybe I can take it harder. Mm-hmm. But if they're like 10 to 20, I'm like 12, then like maybe I need it to be softer.
Yeah. One thing you were talking about that made me think of this part in the new Topping book where I forget if it's Dusty Easton or Janet Hardy, but one of them describes that they had had a scene where someone, they were in subspace and someone asked them a question and they remember thinking to themselves, "I'm not a thing that decides."
That's so relatable.
Exactly. Like, I've so been in that moment where they're like, "I need you to decide between this and this." And you're like, "I'm not a person who, I'm not a thing that makes choices. I don't," because, yeah, people will ask me questions and I describe subspace, like, the one word I go to most often is that I feel floaty. But it feels like an altered meditative state, and I know that I am a creature that knows language, but it doesn't, it feels like I'm, like, reaching through molasses or quicksand trying to find the words. They're there, but they're just a little harder to get to, and getting to them sometimes means pulling myself a little bit out of this, like, slumber, and I don't always want to do that. So I think it is, for me, helpful. I do also sometimes get a block where I'm like, I just feel like I can't always speak up. I'll get nervous or anxious or whatever. And it feels like the hurdle of creating conversation where there was none before
feels
huge. And I know that about myself, and I communicate that before the scene even starts. And then, because I have a decent amount of experience doing this, I know what it feels like to feel subspacey, and I can feel myself reaching that tipping point, and I will say, "I'm starting to get floaty, I'm going to need you to check in more often now." And then following that, I will have them check in, whether it's just with a hand squeeze and a nod, or asking, you know, "How are you feeling? Do you need anything right now?" And just giving me, just opening the door for conversation to start makes it a little bit easier for me to, like, find that place and come back a little bit.
Yes.
But sometimes, if you're not a person who experiences subspace, think about how you would talk to your really drunk friend. when you're just like...
Or a child.
Or a child, yeah. The person where you're just like, come on, like, you know, if you have someone who, you know, or if you're a person who does drugs and you're like talking to someone and getting them through a trip or something, this is an altered state. They are somewhere else for a minute, and everyone's going to deal with that differently, but very few people in subspace are going to be able to communicate the same way they would have out of it.
Yes,
and
I would add
little tricks, little nonverbal hand squeezes, or, you know, if you've got a ball gag in and you drop a keys and the sound alerts everyone as a safe word. Little things.
Nonverbal signals are great.
Yeah.
I would add, as a dominant or a top, you can create a culture in your relationship or even in your scene. Like, it could be a one-off scene where you establish very, very clearly that your sub communicating with you about their boundaries and needs and how they're feeling is something that you want. I have not had every dominant do that, and I really appreciate it when they do. And, like, my partner, for example, when I tell them that I can't take anymore or when I safe word, they almost always say to me, "Thank you for telling me," which is huge, because as a sub, I really don't want to disappoint my dom. And so if I safe word and they seem kind of bummed about it, I'm going to be less likely to safe word the next time that I need to, which sucks. So creating a culture within your environment where it's really, really easy for your sub to be honest with you about what's going on for them is really, really beneficial for both of you.
Something I think, kind of a jumping off point from there, because we are both rather rambly today. I think something that's helpful to negotiate, because you mentioned safe wording, is does red mean the scene is over, or does red mean we need to stop for a minute and fix something and go back to it? Because I know that for some people, you know, maybe I need to red for this spanking, but I still want to be in scene. I still want to do this other thing. And they may not red because they may think that red means we're done playing and this person's leaving now.
Right. And it's
and
it's
for some people, it does mean that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's tough when you have roles, though, because I know if I said red and my partner immediately stopped being the daddy dom, that would be hard for me because I'm very much in sub land at that point. And I need the support of my daddy dom at that moment. When I say red, what I mean is I want all of the physical action to stop, but I probably want us to stay in role.
Yeah.
I think if I didn't, I would have to specify that.
Yeah.
But because, like, that would be a situation where, like, the emotional role was the thing that was triggering me and making me want to stop. But I think generally, I mean, I want the physical action to stop. But that's something you should discuss because, yeah, you're right. It's not always clear what does a safe word mean. And, like, you might not always have time to discuss that, like, especially, like, before a one-off thing. But, you know, it's good to do.
Yeah, I was thinking about this recently because I was reading someone's FetLife writing on their, like, negotiations. And they use red as stop, but we're still in scene and we'll talk and there may be some more play things after or whatever. But if you say red like multiple times in succession, two or more times, that stops everything and, you know, we have access to support that maybe isn't the dominant if we need it. And like, we are done, and we will get you, you know, whatever safety care thing that you need. And I thought it was interesting to have that distinction. Because there have definitely been moments where I was maybe a yellow and was like, do I want a red on this? Because I don't know if I want to be done, but I don't know how I feel about, like, maybe hitting that corner of my butt again. And not having discussed that, being like, well, if I say red, because people think safe wording is a lot scarier than it is, which is not super healthy, because that defeats the point of safe word. One more before we wrap up this long and meandering episode. I'm curious if you have any suggestions for folks being more in tune with their body and being more expressive during scenes without necessarily being conscious of it all the time. Because that is a thing that a lot of dominants talk about wanting or desiring out of their scenes is just being able to elicit responses and reactions from their submissive, right? And we talk about this being in this, like, altered state and not wanting to think all the time. How do we provide those reactions and kind of communicate in the affirmative without constantly feeling like we're performing?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring up performing because I actually think thinking of it as a performance is a good starting point. Because if you start pretending and putting on a bit of a show and, I mean, not lying, like make the pleasure noises when you're actually feeling pleasure, but do amp it up a little bit. I have always found that doing that and being a little bit theatrical brings me a little bit closer to doing that naturally. I think it gets me more comfortable with doing that. And so I'm more likely to start doing it. But I would also advocate what my friend Caitlin K. Roberts would call mindful masturbation, which is to say masturbation where you're like mindful, like you're aware of everything you're feeling in your body. You're really focusing it on it rather than being sort of mechanical or perfunctory. And I would say give yourself permission to be theatrical and to be very physical in your masturbation, because I always think masturbation is a good starting point if you're trying to learn a particular behavior or skill for to share with a partner. Like masturbation, if you can do it, is a good place to practice that. So maybe practice being a bit more expressive when you masturbate, like making a bit more noise or whatever. And you know, you could also watch porn of people who are very noisy or very expressive kind of for ideas, which seems like if you were imitating them that you would be faking it in some way. But I think actually what it does is it gives you permission, or it gives you a sense of the range of what's possible. And so it might make you feel a little bit less weird or awkward about making noise or being expressive.
Yeah, I like what you said about masturbation, because I think you can, some people don't even know what kind of noise to make. or what kind of movement to do. So I like the idea of masturbation because you can try shit on your own. And if you sound ridiculous, you can laugh and move on because no one else saw you. And you can just kind of...
But can I add, you might think you sound bad, but other people might think you sound super hot. So try not to judge yourself. Like, it's like when you record your own voice, like every fucking week when I listen to this podcast, I'm like, dear God, do I sound like that? Like, it's okay if you don't like the way you sound because someone else probably will.
Oh yeah, totally. And there are definitely times also where I hear things and I'm like, oh, that would sound hot, but that just does not feel genuine to me and the way that I sound. Like, genuine to my pleasure. And I like what you had to say about performance, because I think we're in this weird place culturally where we see this dichotomy between performance and sex. There's a lot of conversation around feminist porn with that.
Performance versus authenticity, whatever that
versus, means. Yeah, exactly. And there's even a lot of discussion about that at my job, where we show videos of quote-unquote real people having real sex. And I think there is a kind of performance that is satisfying to the person performing. Because it is an expression of what is happening to them and their bodies and what feels sexy to them. And I can perform in a way that feels sexy, and it feels good to me in my body to be feeling sexy in that way. And I'm still performing based on things that I've seen people that I think are sexy do, and things that just kind of feel good in my body, and it's still genuine. Versus performing what you think that person wants to see, which is a very different thing.
I think that there's a lot of tension in our culture around, like, wanting to seem like a porn star during sex, but also not wanting to because that seems fake. And I don't think you necessarily need to guilt yourself if you sound like or want to sound like a porn star, like, because those are the ideals of sexiness that are built in our culture. And, you know, like, when I put on clothes that are coded as, like, femininely attractive in magazines I've read and stuff, I am aware that I am adopting cultural ideals of what attractiveness is, but it does make me feel more attractive. So I kind of view it as, like, playing the game, like, gaming the system in a way. Like, you know, it's not necessarily evil as long as you're not taking on negative like value judgments of yourself for doing that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you can recognize the rules of the culture you live in and recognize that they're not perfect, and they're also the rules of the culture you live in, so you got to live within that culture a little bit.
Yeah, like, my idea of what is attractive femininity has forever been poisoned and altered by this culture, but that doesn't mean I don't deserve to feel like an attractive feminine person, you know, so.
Yeah.
Oof, we got into some shit in this show.
We did.
Want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Dildorks. We'd love to know what you took away from this one, because we said a lot of stuff.
We did.
I have been Kate Sloan.
I think it was clever stuff.
I think so. You can find my sex blog at girlyjuice.net and the rest of my writing at katewritesaboutsex.com. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at girly_juice. Where is your stuff?
I'm Bex. You can find all my writing at bextalksex.com, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at bextalksex. Together we're the Dildorks. We're at the Dildorks on Twitter and Instagram and at thedildorks.com. You can also find us by searching the Dildorks in your favorite podcast app. Rate and review us there to bring us up in the charts. It makes us easier to find. You can also head to patreon.com/thedildorks to toss a couple of bucks our way and help us keep doing what we're doing.
This episode, I should say, is a hashtag Dildorks Live episode, which is where we do a monthly live broadcast of the episode. If you're hearing this in your podcast app right now, you're hearing the edited version, so you're not hearing all our mistakes and rambles and jokes in between.
They're hearing most of our rambles, let's be honest.
Yeah, so that is, it's supposed to be monthly. We've been slacking on a little bit lately, but we're trying to get back into it. We have scheduled the show. So that is for people who pledge $5 an episode or higher, and we would really, really appreciate that. And it's super fun having an audience for the show, so thanks for that. Thank you so much to Protodome. He did our theme song. He is at protodome.bandcamp.com. I never spell that, so I'm going to spell it. protodome.bandcamp.com. He's really, really good. Love the guy. Our logo is by Amy. She is at starboots_ on Twitter. And thank you so much to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life.
Bye.
Bye. Watch you in the morning. Let's make a cup of tea. I want you in the morning. Let's stay with me. Tonight I'm drinking scotch, which Sarah bought for me because I took care of her cats for a weekend, and that is true friendship.
This does not trends like these. I am drinking nothing.
That's fine. I was just like, I don't feel charming today.
No, I think that's valid.
Alcohol is a form of nonverbal communication, right?
Nope.
Nope, that doesn't even begin to make sense.
Nope.
Oh, man.
And Lugo was watching Great British Bake Off and saw the mousse challenge and thought it looked delicious, so is buying me the supplies to see if I can learn how to make it.
Oh, I thought you meant cooking like a mousse.
No.
Like the animal.
No.
No.
No. Mousse meat. Like the dessert.
Yum.
Oh.
Love it.
No.
There's definitely cat hair in my scotch. Not loving it.
Still drinking it.
I took it out. It's fine. It's fine.
Just for the people who aren't watching the video, you just said that and looked really pensively at your glass and then just drank it anyway.
I took the cat hair out of my mouth and then kept drinking. I'm not going to waste it.
I think that's good. Yeah, no, that's valid.
Waste not, want not. That's my motto.
Who's this otter? Joseph Fischel. Okay.
You said otter instead of author.
I know. It's fine. It was written by an otter. I'm so tired. Okay.
I found that way funnier than I needed to.
It's fine. Can I just tell you, Dick was so much better at promoting our show at Test Fest than I was.
What did he say? I want to know. I love it.
Like, every time he introduced me to someone, he's like, this is Bex. He's on this great podcast. It's called The Dildorks. And, like,
he's honestly an angel, and I love him so much.
He's so good, and he told everyone about it and was always like, it's really great, and, like, kept being like, you know, ours is a kink-specific podcast, but theirs is more generalized sexuality. And I'm like, yeah, we wrote and branded it that way, but we're fucking perverts. So
yeah,
it's kind of a kink show.
About kink in every episode. Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you're not kinky, listening to this show would be kind of a weird experience.
Yeah,
but perhaps eye opening.
Yeah, I mean, probably fascinating.
I hope.
Yeah, but I would definitely say we probably qualify as a kink podcast at this point.
I think so. Yeah,
we are.
I love
who
Dick.
Are.
I think Dick is the only person who's ever brandished a knife at me and who still I love. So, I mean, that's a high honor.
He's so delightful.
He's so wonderful. I love him. I've said I love him so many times.
You have.
I need to stop.
You should edit some of those out.
No,
I assume
no,
some of it will
I'm
going
to keep him in.
Okay.
I want him to know. I really want him to know that. And not just because I'm drunk, I swear.